a success story in Australia of what could be done after the World War, after World War II. We currently have, as everybody now is aware, a debt-based money system that is guaranteed to fail. It's guaranteed that there are the very countries that are using it, because it will bankrupt them eventually, because it doesn't print the interest that it demands back. So slowly but surely, it does suck the lifeblood out of any economy as fast as they choose to take it out of us with its interest rates.
Yep. And also the commitment to speculation that the banking system is so committed, so engorged on this whole idea of these instruments called derivatives and these fancy paper instruments that have no value. So consequently, the entire system is engorged with these things instead of having a banking system that is committed to supporting what we call the physical economy of the nation, that is real wealth. That is the way that we have to go back. And there's plenty of models for these sorts of things. See, there's three principal policies that we support down here, and it's part of the international LaRouche movement. The first is that we must have immediately a policy of going back to Glass-Steagall, re-regulating the banking system and bring the banks back under control so that they become banks for the purpose of supporting the physical economy. Do what banks are supposed to do. Instead of becoming casinos, put them back to being banks. Secondly, down here in Australia, we have to immediately establish a national bank that would, in a sense, re-regulate the entire banking system, but also emit large amounts of credit for large-scale infrastructure development projects. Now, we're in a largely undeveloped country down here in terms of infrastructure. One of the premier ideas that we support, it was put forward by Professor Lance Endersby, who passed away just a couple of years ago now, who was one of the pioneering engineers on the only national development project we've ever had in this country, called the Snowy Mountain River Scheme, which feeds water into the Murray-Darling Basin irrigation process, but also provides huge amounts of hydroelectric power on the east coast of Australia. Now, Professor Endersby was one of the young engineers that participated in the Tennessee Valley Authority's projects in the United States under Franklin Roosevelt in the 30s. So he came back to Australia, participated in the Snowy Mountain Scheme, and had a passion for large-scale infrastructure projects, one of which is called the Australian Ring Road Proposal, which is to build a high-speed railway system around Australia to break the tyranny of distance. Now, we've extended that idea to the fact that we believe we need to have a high-speed magnetic levitation train system, as is being built right now in China. So there's nothing new about this technology, but one going from Melbourne, which is in the southern eastern tip of Australia, right up to Darwin, as a high-speed transport corridor for both people and for freight, because these magnetic levitation trains can have carriages in them that can each hold 20 ton. And if you had 10 carriages in a row, that's 200 ton of freight speeding at 400-500 kilometers per hour. And this will be high value produce, high value fruit, vegetables and so forth that could be, or seafood or whatever, be exported up through into Asia, which is our largest market. So we would then, by developing this high-speed rail network, you could break the tyranny of distance, which is the biggest single problem we have in our country. To jump in a car and to drive to Darwin from Melbourne is about 3 days driving safely. So to have a high-speed rail system makes a lot of sense. So that would be the first thing. And then we would extend that rail system from the far north right the way down into Western Australia and across into the eastern states again. So you literally have a ring rail system. Now people say, oh, but it'll cost a huge amount of money. Oh, you can't do that. Where are you going to get the finances from? Because they're thinking in terms of, again, private capital, private corporations, private banks. And that's the disaster in people's thinking. If you have a government that says, we want to have this for the future value economically, that as an asset for future generations, we will create the credit necessary to do this So you're creating the credit against the intention of future wealth.
Yeah, now, this is what we were talking about before we came on air, wasn't it? We were actually talking about the very same thing.
Yeah.
And that is that if the power to create currency and credit was returned to where it belongs, which is the elected government of the day, then yes, of course, they would be issuing 0% credit to improve infrastructure services and everything else, because we are the money. Our actual labour is the money. That's what they trade in. We are the stock. Yeah, I know the actual metals and materials themselves have to be provided, but at 0%, you know, whatever we build, we'll pay that cost back over time. It is the interest that strangles the economy.
Well, yeah, the what you're talking about is what Mr. LaRouche refers to as the powers of labour. And I think there's a classic example. I don't know how many of your listeners have ever had a chance to come down to Australia, but there's a famous Sydney Harbour Bridge. You might see it on the Olympics, you know, what we call the giant coat hanger, that was built by Jack Lang, Premier Jack Lang, in the 1920s and the 1930s. And you have to think about that infrastructure. I think it cost about $50 to $80 million to build back in the 20s and 30s, which was a huge amount of money back then. But don't think about it in terms of money. Think about it in terms of how easy it now is to transport goods from the northern part of Sydney across the bridge into the southern part of Sydney. That city would not survive. It would be starved if it didn't have that piece of infrastructure. So the infrastructure serves as a catalyst towards economic development, which is why we propose the Australian Ring Road proposal. For example, it would go up through a town called Dubbo in New South Wales. Now, to hop in your car and drive to Dubbo would be 8 hours. So people fly. It's still 8 hours if you fly by the time you get in and off an aircraft, go through the congested airports, park your cars in parking, all that sort of stuff. It's still a lot of time to fly because you've got all that wastage. But if you had a high-speed rail system, maglev, that's 800 kilometres away. That's an hour and a half. So not only would you have people travelling from Melbourne to Dubbo for a day, you'd have people from Dubbo travelling back to Melbourne. So what do? You increase the ability for people to interact commercially, to buy goods and services, and therefore you expand your economy through the infrastructure. Therefore, you expand your economy, you know, through the processes of minimal taxation. You can then recover what is necessary to fund the necessary education, hospital and so forth expenses within your nation if you don't fund that through national banking itself.
So you're using common sense to come to these decisions, and that's not what the powers that be, that's not what the power and control systems demand. They want to actually enslave us by controlling every part of our lives, and they want to make us poor because poor people will do us the tort. They will have no option if they want to get fed.
There's a great story in classical mythology of the gods of Olympus, right, where Zeus casts out Prometheus because Prometheus gives man fire. Now, fire literally means, actually literally fire, but also knowledge or forethought. Now, the gods of Olympus feared the fact that you would have an educated citizenry. Because once you have an educated citizenry, you don't need an oligarchy, you don't need empire. You actually have what's called actually a true republic. Now, that is what they fear. If you have an educated citizenry that is satisfied because their general welfare has been looked after, then you won't have a need for empire, you won't have a need for oligarchy. And that's what they're terrified of most about. Forget about the money, Paul. That's not the issue. The issue is the question of power. And whenever the, for example, the establishment of the original U.S. colony in the Massachusetts Bay Colony in the United States, it developed its own currency, the pine shilling currency. Actually, it was what it was called. And it had its own systems of internal trade, and it prospered hugely under its own internal system of credit. It was smashed by the British, I think under George the First, because that meant that they were becoming too independent. They were actually demonstrating the power of controlling one's own credit. And right throughout history, I mean, the American Revolution was fought not because it was fought along the lines of the British system of free trade being undermined by the US principles of supporting the general welfare. And there's a whole history there relating to the founding of Australia that comes from that, because we were founded basically more from a point of view of a military outpost and a place of putting 160,000 Irish and particularly mainly Irish and Scottish prisoners in order to shut down the dissent within Ireland and within Scotland because of the enthusiasm that came from the victories of the American Revolution. 160,000 people were transported out here over the period of about 80 years from 1788 through to about 1868. And this was all based upon, again, the British Empire trying to maintain its dominance in the world after the defeat of the after its defeat at the American Revolution. So, look, the issue is not money. Money is an idiot. The control of money is an issue because it means the control of credit. If you have sovereign nations that control their own credit, then it is the intention of those nations for that credit to develop their populations for the future posterity of generations to come. And that's the real battle. If you dumb people down through cutting education, if you can't supply a decent food supply, or you promote policies that literally kill them through the obesity epidemic, you know, which is a recent phenomenon actually, compared to 100 years ago, these sorts of policies of healthcare denial, of access to poor food, even access to no food, you know, privatization of water so you can't produce the food is another one in agricultural areas. See, all these policies can be overturned in a very quick period of time if you have governments that support this concept of the general welfare, which is what we actually talk about a lot. And I mean, there is no shortage here in Australia of magnificent large-scale infrastructure development projects that we could build to create large numbers of jobs, high-paying jobs for people. And the other thing is, I don't know how much our reputation has preceded us up there, but we have a lot of boat people coming to Australia that are escaping, you know, particularly various civil wars and internal conflicts, whether it be Afghanistan or whether it be Iraq in the past or Sri Lanka, and where our government here is adopting a hideous policy of sticking them basically in concentration camps on remote Pacific islands in order to avoid having them come onto the Australian mainland. Now, this is it's a racist policy, but it's typical of the sort of nasty policies that are inherent with this British free trade agenda that we seem to be suffering from. I mean, we're only 22 million people. People might look at a map and see the island of the island state of Tasmania, which is the bastion of the Greens here, the Green movement. Now, it is basically large wilderness areas, Paul, you know, locked up in national reserves and national parks. It has a population density of 7.8 people per square kilometre. If you apply that to the entirety of Australia, we could easily support, at the levels of population density of Tasmania, 55 million people. We're only 22. And so to knock people coming across by boats back, and there's only, you know 5,000, 6,000, 7,000 of these coming per year, is an absolute insanity. We can put these people to good work if we had large-scale development projects for them to participate in.
Now, here in the UK, if I was to ask any sort of regular English person, where would you choose to live if it wasn't in England? I would say more than half would choose the country of Australia. And I know many, many people who have flown to Australia, loved it so much, and they've managed to stay. And those that can't are very disappointed that they can't. Now, I think one of your countrymen, Max Egan, his name is, he claims that 7 billion people can be given a house, a garden. This is individual people, not families. 7 billion people can be given a house and a garden and fit in Australia with a quarter of it left empty. Yeah. And look, that in many ways illustrates to those that don't know, that we're not overpopulated at all. And this eugenics, we'll have to get rid of a few people, supporters. Well, I always say to them, well, if you think there's too many people on the planet and we should get rid of a few, go and join the queue.
We can support 100 million people, Paul, just in the north of our country with basic development of infrastructure through water projects and through agriculture. It's a huge food bowl up there. And 100 million people is just the start of it. So when he's talking about 7 billion, I mean, that is the that's giving a population density of, you know, something which is not already unknown in other parts of the world. If you hop in a car, and drive, once you get about 2 hours outside of Melbourne, you can drive for 3 days and hardly see a person. You see more kangaroos than you will see people. And a lot of these areas.
It could be more different from the size of the country you live in to the size of the country I live in. We are a tiny little island that exerts far too much influence over the rest of the world. It's quite an achievement, isn't it?
Well, that's deliberate. I mean, the point is that by virtue of the size of your country, I mean, the establishment there knew that they had to be very smart in controlling the wishes of many other countries in order to stay safe. And that's been the history of the oligarchy in England for a long time, is to control the mindset and the way that people think in order to be able to stay safe, or so they think, or stay in control. So, I mean, like I say, as you say, people come down to Australia, they like the place, they like to stay here, and you know, that's fine too, because you know, we are a great country to live in. Unfortunately, we are still a colony of Great Britain. We're still a colony of the Crown, and whilst we remain like that, we will never be independent and able to develop ourselves to the extent that we are able to through all these through the process of national banking. Ironically, you know, there's only been two places or two countries in the world where national banking has actually been practiced. One is the United States, and the other is here in Australia. And, you know, we have this rich history through the Commonwealth Bank of showing how you can develop a country through national banking, which terrifies the financial establishment. And, you know, we've had courageous old Labor politicians that have fought this ever since as an ongoing battle over the years. One of those persons was Premier Jack Lang, who, after World War One, was faced with the Great Depression. Now, we lost 60,000 men in World War One out of a population of just 4 million people in the meat grinder war of Gallipoli that Winston Churchill, as the Secretary of the Foreign Office, I think it was at that time, it could have been the Home Office, not sure, was presiding over. We lost 60,000 of our best. I mean, these men, they weren't, you know, small-framed people. They were the best of the cream of the crop in terms of our men. And they were slaughtered at Gallipoli and places like that for no reason, in defence of the empire, so to speak. Now, Jack Lang had the attitude that the bondholders of England were wanting to be repaid at the expense of the blood of the people of New South Wales. He was the Premier of New South Wales, and he said, no, I will not pay back the bondholders at this present time. We're going to use the money to support public works for our state. Now, he was sacked by Sir Philip Game, the governor of New South Wales, for doing that. And 400,000 people came out into the street out of a population of just under 1 million people to support him when that happened, because he was acting on the interests of the general welfare for the people of New South Wales. In 1975, Paul, we had Gough Whitlam, Prime Minister Gough Whitlam. Now, he came to power after about 23 years of having a Liberal government here, you know, of Sir Robert Menzies. And Sir Robert Menzies was the Prime Minister before John Curtin and Ben Chifley came to power, who basically had this idea of not defending Australia against the Japanese invasion that was later to happen. Now, when Gough Whitlam came to power, he had the Treasurer was Jim Cairns, and you had Rex O'Connor, who was the Minister for works and so forth here in Australia. And they had a policy of buying back the farm, of buying back the resource companies like Rio Tinto and so forth, and nationalising them for the interests of Australia. And he went outside the normal systems of British finance and went actually to Arab finances to get the money to be able to do this, to literally take back ownership of these mineral companies for the sake of our country and to develop them. Now, he was sacked by the Queen for doing so. And just recently, in fact, about 3 weeks ago, it came out how the Governor General, Sir John Kerr, had liaised with Prince Philip personally whilst Prince Philip was up in, it was Prince Charles up in Papua New Guinea, about whether the Queen would frown on this particular approach or not. And basically, through her private secretary, she signed off on the deal to sack Whitlam before Whitlam could sack Sir John Kerr. Now, it's ironic that the Queen is the largest, it's not ironic, it's actually the reason why this happened, is she's the largest shareholder in a company, Rio Tinto, that literally ripped out over $80 billion of wealth out of Australia over the last 10 years. So this is the reach of the empire. When people say, oh, the empire doesn't exist anymore, it's just a load of rubbish. Of course it exists, but it exists in a different form that people don't look at.
You're absolutely right. I mean, we can now be comfortable saying that the Queen, Queen Elizabeth II, personally, not just the family, her personal signature or ownership, she can lay claim to 16% of this planet's surface. It is hers. That includes the seas as well. But the landmass that she actually claims ownership to, if it were converted into rental value, the rental value of the landmass that she claims to, lays claim to, is $33 trillion a year. A year. It's quite amazing that we've managed to let these people get to this stage while still thinking here in the UK that they're actually good for tourism, and lots of knickknacks are sold, and it's all good business. We're happy to have them. When the true fact is that she could clear off the national debt and restore the wealth and pride in this nation, and it wouldn't really make a dent in the bank account at all.
Well,
it's just the ignorance of the public is something that we have to learn to overcome and break through. And just every now and again, I get a little bit frustrated.
Well, that's the 25 years of battles that we've had down here, Paul, have always been. We've always been encouraged by the people that have taken this fight up to the money power, as we call them. And that's the British Empire. And, you know, when we first were established as a penal colony, we had 160,000 convicts sent down here over that 80-year period starting 1788. There was a great fellow, one of the founding fathers of our country, Dr. John Dunmore Lang, who was a Scottishman. He came out here at the age of 24, and he saw the brutality and hated it as a Presbyterian clergyman. And he began to organise for what he referred to as the United States of Australia, based upon the model of America, that we would be a great, you know, free country. And he began to organise here in Australia for that particular ideal. Now, we've got many poets down here. Another one's by the name, one of them by far is Charles Harper, an Australian poet that no one ever hears about, a tremendous poet that we study down here as part of our political work. Ironically, you might find this, or your listeners might find this rather unique, but because we believe in this principle of creativity, that all human beings are creative, we actually have classical music training as part of our political work down here, which means we have a very important local bass baritone vocal teacher take our young people and myself included for classical music training. We also study poetry, and we also study great theological works, like, for example, the works of Nicholas of Cusa. Now, this is not done for religious purposes, but it's actually done to really study philosophy, to study how the human mind works, how creativity works, because ultimately, amongst all the hideous stuff that we have to put up with, it's this question of being truly human, being actually creative, that really is where you find the strength to be able to continue the day-by-day fight. And when you know, because we actually are a bit like an island here, island within an island politically, you might say, on these particular ideas. However, we are joined by people of great importance around the world that believe in these very same principles. For example, you can see Cristina Kirchner from the president of Argentina implementing these policies of sovereign national development. I mean, she just recently encouraged 800 scientists to come from Spain into Argentina in order to develop their internal economy, because they, about eight years ago, denounced the policies of usury, denounced the policies of finances, and began to implement policies to develop their local internal economy using these principles that I've been talking about of national sovereignty. So you have a few of these lights on the horizon that are implementing these sorts of policies. But at the end of the day, it is us as human beings, as creative individuals, if we sponsor that creativity and develop it as you would in a child, then that's where the future actually lays. And all the other things, all the other problems that we have can be solved very, very quickly.
I agree entirely. It is the reason we're in this mess is because this is where we are, and we need to realize this isn't where we want to be. And the way we're going to get out of this is to respond to this challenge. I see this as a personal challenge for me. Can I understand what is wrong, and then can I learn what to do to make it better and try and fix it? And I see that as a challenge that I'm never going to give up with now. I wish I'd joined the challenge 20 years earlier, but I didn't know it existed then. But now I know it does. And now I know that it is, you know, the person who looks back at me in the mirror is the one that's going to fix my problems in my life. And I'm going to actually learn how to share how I fix my problems with other people, and they'll learn how to fix theirs. And all of a sudden, we'll have a positive mindset and a population that wants to fix the problems as opposed to blame everybody else.
Yeah. I think that's where it gets down to the idea of politics as intensely personal. And where people say, well, I'll leave it up to the other person to deal with this, I won't get involved. Well, guess what? You get the politicians, the people elect. You get the government that you actually elect. So if you're not involved implicitly in the process, you get what you deserve. Unfortunately, that's the reality.
I know it is. Now, time is marching on, and let's run down how we can find out what the Citizens Electoral Council are up to. It's www.cecaust.com.au. Is that correct?
Yeah, Paul, and the best thing for people to do is to jump on and get our emails, because we send out up to 3 emails a week on vital subjects, and the website is regularly updated. We do have publications too, which people would have to write in for, but we don't really. They're mainly Australian-based publications, so it would be a different matter to be able to post them overseas.
Well, I think some of the subject matter that you have on the newspapers that you've put up on the website are, it's all global stuff.
Yes.
I mean, I am aware of Mr. Lyndon LaRouche and have been for some time. I mean, I think it was his 90th birthday last week. And, yeah. You know, does he run the biggest private news service? Is it the biggest private news service on the planet?
Well, it's the Executive Intelligence Review news service, which was described I think one of President Reagan's staffers back in the 80s is the finest private intelligence.
That's the word I want to
get. Agency in the world. Back in 1991, Paul, I was responsible, in a sense, to bring Mr. LaRouche's organisation, or the ideas of Mr. LaRouche's organisation, into Australia, which caused a monumental freakout, I must say, because he is recognised as the world's foremost proponent for the American system of political economy, which are the economic ideas I've been talking about. So we brought this and established our organisation in the heart of the British Empire, whereas, and this has never happened before in the world. So We represent somewhat of a unique organisation down here, and we've had our battles where they've tried to get rid of us too. So we've survived because our intention is to bring these ideas and to transform our country into a sovereign republic and to develop our capability in this region as one of being allowed to, you know, to help other nations develop themselves as well.
I wish you all the success in the world, because if we can find one country, and we know Iceland is on the verge of breaking free from these gangsters' grips, but if we can find one country that you know, it overturns the government of the day, just like Iceland have done, we're gonna win. But how much are we gonna lose before we get to the winning post? Because it is a race. We know it is. We're going to have to lose an awful lot more before people actually... I mean, I don't think people really get involved in understanding what's going on until they haven't got anything left.
Well, that's when...
It's when the system comes and it rapes them, and then they've got nothing left, and it comes back for more. And it's then that they think, hang on, I don't have enough to even feed myself. You know, it's a mafia control system that... Well, with radio shows just like this, all we can do is share the word, share the information, share the things that matter, and the people who are listening, who are going to make the change, they're going to be hearing what we're talking about. Well, so I do wish you all the success in the world, sir.
Thank you very much, Paul. It's been good to chat.
It's been a pleasure to talk to you. Have a good day in Australia. I'll bid you farewell. And what I will do after I finish the show, I'll post a link to the show so you can listen to your heart's content. Thank you, Mr. Craig Isherwood. Thank you.
Thank you, Paul.
Right, sir.
Yeah.